I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, as the nation marks the birthday of civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr., we decided to spend a good part of the program talking about his legacy. We'll hear excerpts from some of his less well-known but equally important addresses. But equally important, we'll get diverse perspectives about the new frontiers in the fight for social justice. Later in the program, we'll hear from human rights advocate Carrie Kennedy, daughter of the late Robert F. Kennedy, about why she thinks bullying should be considered a human rights issue, and we'll also hear from a scholar about the role he thinks hip-hop is playing in shaping political attitudes. That's all later. But the first thing we want to do is talk about Dr. King's legacy and the role it plays in our politics today, or doesn't. So we've called upon a diverse group of our regular contributors who we thought would have interesting perspectives on this. Joining us is Kai Wright. He is the editorial director of Colorlines.com. He reports on race, sexuality, and health. Also with us, Viviana Hurtado. She's the blogger-in-chief of the site The Wise Latina Club. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney and the author of the book Islamic Pacifism, Global Muslims in the Post-Osama Era. And last but not least, R. Clark Cooper. He is the executive director of the group Log Cabin Republicans. That is an organization of gay and lesbian members of the GOP. He's also an Army Reserve captain. Welcome to you all, and thank you all so much for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day.
Thanks for having us,
Michelle.
To start us off, we thought it was worth remembering or reminding ourselves that although many Americans associate Dr. King with the fight to end institutionalized discrimination against black people in the U.S., his vision was always broader than that. Here's an excerpt from a speech at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. It was delivered in 1968, just a couple of days before he died. And he had started speaking out in ways that often challenged his political allies on issues like war and poverty. Here it is.
There comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic. Not popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right.
So let me start by asking each of you what the civil rights movement means to each of you now, and if you draw lessons from Dr. King's work. And Kai, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, first and foremost, you know, as an African-American, the civil rights movement means I have rights that I didn't have when my parents were children. But I think what's one of the striking things is, you know, in this past year, as we've seen the widespread return of a protest movement over economic justice and Occupy Wall Street, I think that's really resonant to where he left off in the clip we just heard.
Arsalan, how about you?
Well, as a civil rights lawyer, I mean, there's not a day that doesn't go by where I'm not reminded of the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. I think that anybody who spends their life trying to make sure that our nation's constitutional and legal principles are upheld for every person, regardless of their race, religion, socioeconomic status, or sexual orientation, I think that his legacy will continue to live on for centuries.
What, how does it speak to you specifically? I mean, I'm particularly noting that the title of your book is Islamic Pacifism. Mm-hmm. So is that where you draw the inspiration from?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, within the 20th century, we had, you know, modern pacifist giants like Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King. I think that Dr. King helped bring that nonviolent sociopolitical ethos to American shores. Everybody knew about Gandhi in the abstract, but I think that with Dr. King, you know, here we saw an American who brought those principles here stateside and was able to bring about social change through those things. And I think that a lot of people, including myself, are going to use those legacies moving forward.
How about you, Viviana Hurtado?
I think about how Dr. King's legacy has really impacted every aspect of my life. I am the daughter of Colombian immigrants who came to this country looking for a better life for their children. And as I look at every aspect of my life through education, through my career, Dr. King's legacy lives in the opportunities that he fought for and that are still continuing to be fulfilled. And because of those opportunities that I was given professionally in my life, through these struggles, he gave me the opportunity and the guts and the courage to dare to dream.
Hmm. How about you, Clark?
This is about the ability to pursue liberty and prosperity in this country. And we've, as Americans, have had these ideals that we strive toward. We've been imperfect throughout our history, but those ideals, those visions have remained the same. And we claim to be a meritocracy. We're becoming closer and closer to that. and any barriers toward achieving those goals. And we can succeed or fail, but having those barriers removed and letting one's individual liberty and their individual responsibility allow them to succeed or fail. And so Dr. King's legacy for everyone is to have that ability to succeed or fail.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. On this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we're taking a look at King's legacy and his influence on our politics today with a diverse panel of guests who all have some connection to the civil rights movement or who work in civil rights today. But Clark, talk a little bit, if you would, about how you see the connection between your work and Dr. King's work. I mean, as you know, that there are some people who take issue with the idea of comparing, you know, the civil rights struggle for African-Americans or people of some racial and ethnic group with the question of sexual orientation.
Sure. Well, there are some corollaries, and let's be fair, there are differences. There are, you know, average gay American doesn't have, they're not encumbered by the orientation to, they're not not allowed to vote. There's no poll tax. There's no literacy test for gay Americans. In fact, your basic civil rights are there. There is an issue regarding human rights, being denied access or privileges, sure. But to equate the barriers that existed for an entire population solely on race, being denied basic civil rights, it is very different. I can totally appreciate the differences as to why some would say they're not the same, because they're not.
Kai, I do want to go back to something you talked about earlier, the whole question of the fight or attention to poverty. Toward the end of his life, Dr. King started to spend a lot more time talking about questions of poverty and equal opportunity. This is him again at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. This was in March of 1968. Here it is.
We read one day, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life, nor liberty, and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists."
Now, Kai, I'm interested in this because there are people at the time within the civil rights movement who thought that this was a distraction and that this would just muddy the message. And in fact, Dr. King spoke of this, but he felt as well. He just explained what he thought. So, Kai, I'm interested in your take on this, since you raised the whole question of a parallel to the Occupy movement today.
Yeah. And I mean, so this and on the war, but by that point in his career, folks did not want him to start muddying the picture. And he felt that the picture is already muddied, right? that all of these things are tied together, and you can't address one without addressing the others. And I think that's important to think about today. His central analysis on economic justice was that racism is a tool of theft. So one of his great quotes, and I'll mangle it, was that if it can be said that the slave owner took freedom and gave the black man the Bible, the Southern aristocracy took everything and gave the white man Jim Crow. And I think we can see that today in this the debate about the 1% versus the 99%. But I think when a lot of the division that we see in society is often used to justify theft. And I think that was his analysis then, and I think it holds true today.
Mm. Arsalan Iftikhar, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, what we always try to teach people in terms of civil rights is the protection of the civil rights of one American is the protection of the civil rights of all Americans. So if you go back to Brown versus the Board of Education, a seminal landmark Supreme Court case, which was about a young 7-year-old girl in Topeka, Kansas, who was not allowed to go to school. Well, that legal precedent set the stage and the legal precedent for Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which bans employment discrimination of any kind. So people like Clark, myself, Viviana, are protected by the rights that were afforded to us by the plight of people that might not look anything like us or share demographic features. And that's why it's important to keep in mind that, you know, whether it's gay rights, whether it's, you know, the rights of ethnic minorities in America today, that civil rights as we know it in America is something that should transcend all national, ethnic, religious, and sexual orientation boundaries.
But Clark, though, I want to ask you, though, as a conservative, because your group is largely conservative.
Well, we are. We're an ancillary group of the Republican
right.
Party.
So I'm interested in how you would interpret from your values perspective Dr. King's insistence that it can't just be about, you know, race and ethnicity. It also has to be about economic fairness.
From a conservative standpoint, what ties into social justice, so to speak, would be removing certain barriers that may be tied with government regulation for, say, a small businessman or a woman. Having that freedom, that flexibility to be able, again, to succeed or to fail. And so this is why there are, Dr. King included, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, this is why there's a historic line of black Republicans out there who actually did take the view of, well, not everyone's going to be in lockstep on what that definition is, on what is access to social justice.
Is that your sly way of reminding us that Dr. King was a registered Republican?
Yes, he was.
Okay. And, you know, I just wanted to jump in here and say, you know, what's the beauty of Dr. King's legacy and words is how elastic they are. I mean, think about everybody who's participating in this conversation and all that we bring to it. I think about how it is that the dream that he defended and that he represented is not his dream. It's not the dream of the civil rights movement. It's not the dream of African Americans. It's all of our dream. And I think about, you know, going back to the whole poverty and inequality question today, 6 months ago, we weren't talking about poverty and inequality. It's because of the Occupy Wall Street movement that we're talking about it. And it's a movement that's incredibly complicated, leaderless, faceless, some people would say smelly. But one thing that is for sure is we've got the largest gap in inequality than we've had in generation in the Latino community in particular. Between 2008 and 2010, the Latino household wealth went down 66%, and more Latino children are living in poverty than any other group of kids from other ethnic or racial groups. This is nothing but a call and a rally to action to continue pressing forward with Dr. Martin Luther King's dream.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this discussion of the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. with our diverse group of panelists, all of them regulars on this program. Please stay with us on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We're continuing our discussion of Dr. King's legacy and how he's influenced or hasn't today's civil rights and human rights struggles. I'm joined again by Kai Wright, editorial director of ColorLines.com. Viviana Hurtado is the blogger-in-chief of the site The Wise Latina Club. Arsalan Iftikhar, civil rights attorney and author of the book Islamic Pacifism, Global Muslims in the Post-Osama Era. And R. Clark Cooper, who heads the group Log Cabin Republicans. That's an organization that works within the Republican Party to advocate for gays and lesbians. You know, let me turn to a subject now that often is not brought up when it comes to Dr. King, and that is the whole question of foreign policy and peace and war. You know, toward the end of his life, he started speaking out a lot more about Vietnam. He said that he couldn't raise his voice against violence in the ghettos without raising his voice against America's actions during the war. Now, I just want to play a short clip from a speech that he gave called Beyond Vietnam, delivered in April 1967 at New York City's Riverside Church. Here it is.
A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. America, these are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wombs of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born.
Clark, I wanted to ask you, as we mentioned earlier, you're a reservist and a captain. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Do you consider Dr. King's perspective a legitimate critique?
Well, context. Let's start with the foreign policy aspect. I mean, to be fair, Dr. King was not part of the national security paradigm in 1967. He was not fully read in, as we say, on what the needs were, as why we needed a presence in Southeast Asia. And that was a foreign policy priority. It was bipartisan. It didn't matter who the president was. It was necessary at the time. Another aspect of that speech that he made in 1967, beyond Vietnam, was talking about the cruel irony of black men dying over there. And he was referencing the draft. Well, we now have a professional army, professional military. And then as far as the critique, again, that was his opinion as far as what he was looking at on foreign policy. But I could see why that might have caused some concern for those who were supporters of his.
Arsalan, what's your perspective here? I mean, do you feel that Dr. King's analysis still holds?
Well, you know, Michelle, my favorite Dr. King quote was he once said that we will have to repent in this generation not only for the actions of bad people, but also for the appalling silence of good people. And I think what Dr. King did sort of more from the conceptual 30,000-foot altitude view, especially in terms of the peace movement, is help to give a voice to people who were anti-war, who were pro-peace, who wanted to, you know, wanted to end any sort of military intervention across the globe. And I think even today, you know, the anti-war rally, the anti-war movements that we've seen, you know, in the last 10 years with the war in Iraq and things like that, I think, you know, are legacies of what Dr. King was able to do in terms of giving a voice to people saying that, okay, if you are not moved to action, you have the moral responsibility to at least speak out wherever you feel injustice is being served. And I think that he did a great service in that regard. And I think that many people today are using that legacy in their opposition to war all around the world.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. On this day when we recognize Martin Luther King Jr.'s contributions to this country, we decided to talk about his legacy with a diverse group of our regular contributors. We're talking about how Dr. King's legacy influences civil rights and political struggles. Is there someone who inspires you today? And I don't know, Viviana, do you want to start? Is there someone?
It's really interesting because I've had this discussion with a lot of people in my community that in our community right now, where arguably immigration is the civil rights firebrand of our generation, that there doesn't seem to be one character, one leader who's emerged. And certainly we had that in the 1960s in the form of Cesar Chavez, the late Cesar Chavez, and the living legend Dolores Huerta. And somebody said to me, thank goodness there's not one Latino Dr. King. In fact, may there be 10, may there be 100, may there be 1,000. And I see a lot of inspiration in these dreamers, these young kids. Many of them are faceless, but they're out there, they're using social media, and they're taking big risks to do what's right for their families, for themselves, for our community, and for our nation.
Kai Wright, what about you?
I actually have to echo that. I think one of the tragic understandings of King is that he was a singular leader and that we should have one today. There were thousands then. I think one of the neat stories of the civil rights movement was in Birmingham when the nation was shocked to see Bull Connor turn his hoses on those young people. They came out on their own. King was in jail. And they had been – the movement had been wrestling with whether or not to put the kids – to bring the kids out. And the kids just came. And they came in wave after wave after wave. And that is one of arguably the most important moments in the history of American 20th century, driven not by one man's leadership but by a bunch of young people showing up. And I think I similarly would point to the Dream Act kids. I'm calling them kids. They're not. But to the young people who have been for the last few years literally risking everything in their lives to stand up and say there's something wrong with our immigration system.
Arsalan Iftikhar?
Well, you know, being the globalist that I am, I tend to take a more international approach. And there are transformational figures. You know, you have Nelson Mandela. The man spent 27 years at Robben Island and was able to come out and ask and beg his society for reconciliation. And I think that that is something that is transformational in nature.
Clark, I'm going to give you the last word.
My mentor since I came to Washington as an intern, Congresswoman Ileana Ross Layton of Florida, first Cuban American woman elected to Congress. She's chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She also is the first Republican on the LGBT Equality Caucus and one of the first Republicans to advocate for open service in the military. She has led by example as someone who has not played identity politics but has embraced American individualism and has said that equality is a conservative tenet. It does fall within liberty and in responsibility, that having equal access, again, allows people to reach their dreams or not. So my personal mentor at this time and has been for many years is Congresswoman or Congressista Ileana Ross Layton.
Well, thank you all so much for spending part of your Martin Luther King Jr. Day with us. And thank you all so much for your insights. R. Clark Cooper is the executive director of the group Log Cabin Republicans. It's a group within the Republican Party that advocates for gays and lesbians. Viviana Hurtado is the blogger-in-chief of the site The Wise Latina Club. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, author of Islamic Pacifism, Global Muslims in the Post-Osama Era. They were all here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios, but with us from NPR in New York, Kai Wright, who is the editorial director of ColorLines.com. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
We've been talking about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., the late civil rights and human rights leader. We want to turn now to another social justice advocate who has another perspective on human rights today. She says that bullying is a human rights issue. Her name is Carrie Kennedy. She is president of the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. She's also the daughter of the organization's namesake, the late Robert F. Kennedy. The Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights is known for raising awareness of human rights abuses around the world, and it typically deals with issues like genocide and environmental justice. But the organization recently decided to include school bullying as one of its areas of advocacy, and Carrie Kennedy is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Now, you know, bullying is certainly something that we've come to understand is pervasive. The U.S. Department of Education says, now this is data from 2007, that about a third of students between the ages of 12 and 18 reported being bullied at school, which is one reason that last year the U.S. Department of Education held the first federally backed summit to address bullying in schools. But I'm wondering why you consider this a human rights issue, such that you would take it on, especially given your reputation for issues like genocide, as we said.
We have the Robert F. Kennedy Center's Speak Truth to Power curriculum, which is taught to about a million high school and middle school students worldwide. It's a 12-week course on human rights, and there are chapters on different human rights defenders and the work that they do. We wanted kids to really relate to this. We are asking them constantly to stand up against their peers when their peers are teasing or bullying others. So I thought that this was a very, very important lesson, not only because it's about bullying, but because our aim is really to get students to self-identify as human rights defenders. And if they can do it as teenagers, middle school and high school level, then I think our country will be better served and our world will be better served by them as they take on more and more positions of power.
You know, some might argue that this is a developmental issue. I mean, if there's something that's that pervasive, then it's something that you grow out of, as opposed to the other issues in human rights where you can't grow out of it. Like, you can't grow out of being a member of a minority group that's targeted for oppression. You can't grow out of, say, if you're a person who is gay and you're in a society that is hostile to you. That's not something you grow out of. And so I think there are people who would argue that bullying is different because that's part of childhood. It's something that has to be taught. People have to be taught out of it, that it's not the same. Could you address that?
Yeah, well, I think that's a myth. First of all, a lot of bully victims will never have a chance to grow out of being a victim because they will never grow up. They are 2 to 9 times more likely to consider suicide than non-victims. And, you know, 85% of bullying cases, there's no intervention or effort made by a teacher or administration. So this is something that all of us have a responsibility for. But I think in terms also of growing out of it, look at the statistic that says a bully is 6 times more likely to be incarcerated by the age of 24 and 5 times more likely to have a serious criminal record when they grow up. So these are people who often grow up to prey on our society.
I'm speaking with Carrie Kennedy. She's president of the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. This is an organization that's known for its advocacy and raising awareness around issues like genocide. The organization is now adopted a new initiative to combat bullying in schools. And Carrie Kennedy is saying that we should think about bullying as another human rights issue. So talk to me, if you would, about this Speak Truth to Power
curriculum. What kinds of lessons do you teach? Who do you teach it to? How does it work?
Well, the Speak Truth to Power curriculum is available online at rfkcenter.org. It's free. It's downloadable. And it's consistent with social studies and English curricula for 46 states. So almost anybody across the country can use it. Our aim there is to not only teach kids about the particular issue, in this case bullying, but also give them concrete tools that they can use so that they can become human rights defenders at the end of this 12-week curriculum. So, for instance, we teach kids to recognize what bullying is. In the last month, have you heard certain words, offensive words, in your school? Every time we ask that, half the room will raise their hands. And does that make you feel safe? Do you think every kid who comes to this school feels safe each day? And, you know, we find across the board, nobody raises their hands because everybody knows that kids in their school are not feeling safe. So the question is, what are we as adults going to do about that? And this curriculum really teaches kids that they can rely on the administration, they can rely on their parents, but they can also take action themselves to stop bullying and to protect themselves and to create an environment that's safe in their schools.
How do you recommend that, particularly the adults in a situation, separate bullying from the give and take that students, particularly older students, should be allowed to have? Like, for example, if you have students who have different perspectives on sexual orientation, I mean, maybe students from a particular religious background who believe that same-sex relationships are wrong and shouldn't be sanctioned and are in the same community with people who feel differently. I mean, how do you keep from making it be politically correct, you know, or just policing speech to the point where people really can't talk about the things that they want to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely fine to disagree on the issues. What you're not allowed to do is start calling people names or doing so in a way that's meant to cause harm. There are things that adults need to do and can do. One is to help kids identify what bullying is. Two, you can know who to call and when to call. So teachers should be told, administrators should be told. If the administration is not taking steps, you can go to the district level, to the state level.
How do you think bullies should be dealt with? Does the RFK Center for Human Rights have a perspective on policies of how bullies should be dealt with? And I'm particularly interested in the fact that a number of communities, after having experienced, you know, tragedies around bullying, have sometimes turned to, you know, stiffening penalties, which sometimes includes incarceration if kids are of a certain age. But the U.S. already has an extremely high rate of incarceration when compared to other countries, and it does seem that certain groups, particularly minority groups, seem to be the ones on whom this falls most heavily. So what is your perspective on how bullies should be dealt with?
Well, in, you know, if people are breaking law, they have to be held responsible. So let's start there. That said, criminalization, punishment really rarely works with bullying. In fact, most people who are bullies are people who have been abused in one way or the other in some other part of their life. And somebody who is bullied at school might come home and bully their younger siblings or their cousins or other people in their neighborhood or in cyberspace. So it's a little bit more complex than identifying one person as the perpetrator and punishing that person.
Finally, before we let you go, when you think about, you know, where we are now, and if you and I were to get together, say, 5 years from now and talk about this, what kind of conversation do you think, you know, we'll have?
I think that it's very positive that the federal government, the Obama administration, has taken a strong stance on this, and there is increasing understanding, recognition of it, and school districts are dealing with it, grappling with it in a way that they really haven't in the past. And that's, I think, particularly appropriate as we're celebrating Martin Luther King Day today, to think about who are the groups of people who are being discriminated against and ostracized because of something about them over which they have no control. And what are we doing to address that as a community? And that's what bullying education is about. And I think 5 years from now, this is going to be a much more widely understood phenomenon. And I think we're going to have better tools in our toolkit to address it.
Kerry Kennedy is the president of the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. She was kind enough to join us on this Martin Luther King Day from our studios in New York. Kerry Kennedy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a moment, my weekly Can I Just Tell You commentary. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we've been talking about the influence of Martin Luther King Jr. on politics and human rights struggles around the world. But now we want to switch gears and talk about the influence of another powerful 20th century phenomenon, hip-hop. That hip-hop even has an impact on politics might seem ridiculous to some. To others, it's a no-brainer as it connects young voters to cause and activism. Now, one of our regular contributors has taken up this question in his book, Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. Lester Spence is an assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. He's also a regular contributor to our barbershop segment. And he's with us once again. Welcome back, Lester. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the idea that hip-hop is a core sort of truth-teller, its primary purpose is to say sort of uncomfortable truth. Has that always been a part of its history?
Yes, it has. Hip-hop starts and rap starts as a way, as a vehicle for working-class Black and Latino youth to express themselves. And although there's this boastful element to it where you have MCs talking about how dope they are, et cetera, people have always made the attempt, at least, to connect them to everyday reality.
What is not in dispute is that hip-hop is associated with a certain generation, the rise of a certain generation with its own kind of preferences around music and style and a beat and so forth. And it doesn't seem illogical to think that a generation that grew up with hip-hop as its primary musical form would also kind of take it into the voting booth, you know, as it were, or take it into the world of political activism. Here's a moment that crystallizes this for you very clearly, which you talk about in the book. The former Detroit mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, elected in 2001 at the age of 31. Of course, he comes from a political family. His mother, Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, was the longtime congressional representative from the Detroit area. And you describe one of his inaugural events where he enters the room, but rather than silencing the crowd in the traditional manner to speak, he finished telling us about that scene and tell us why you found it particularly powerful.
Yeah, I mean, so I was there. There are a number of DJs spinning house, hip-hop all night long, and he comes in while Biz Markie is DJing. And Biz Markie is an old-school MC who's transitioned into being a DJ. And around the time the mayor walks in, Biz starts spinning his own stuff, right? Like, you got what I need, right? And Kwame comes in, and instead of calming everybody down, you know, he takes up the mic, and he starts singing with Biz Markie in the song. And then we all start singing with him. And I remember saying, like, man, this was the most charged political moment of my life. It was like, finally, there was somebody like us in office.
Okay, just to refresh people's memories, this is 1989's Just a Friend. This is DJ Biz Markie. This is not the moment where Kilpatrick took over the mic, but this is the song that he was rapping over.
You got what I need, but you say he's just a friend. And you say he just a friend. Oh, baby, you got what I need. But you say he just a friend. But you say he just a friend. Oh, baby, you got what I need.
Give an example, if you would, or what's your evidence for where hip-hop is in sync with and stimulates and supports the political activism of those for whom it is its primary musical form. I mean, obviously people remember certain moments, like during the presidential campaign when Barack Obama's first running for president and he's having a tough go of it in the primary particularly, and he kind of brushes his shoulder off, which is a gesture that a lot of people associate with hip-hop. I mean, a lot of people do that, brush off the haters. So there's that. And it is true that younger people, by and large, did prefer him to his rival in the 2008 campaign, John McCain. But do you attribute that to hip-hop?
Well, let me answer that question in a different way. So what I try to do with Stare in the Darkness is apply the traditional tools I have as a political scientist to this question, right? So what I did was I both collected survey data and I analyzed pre-existing survey data. The National Black Politics Study is something that is a survey that we've been using for the last almost 20 years to analyze Black attitudes. And what I found, that people who consumed rap were much more likely than people who didn't to engage in what we call non-traditional political behavior, that is protest behavior, right? And then there are a number of other attitudinal connections that we can see between people who listen to rap or prefer rap to other types of attitudes.
The second piece that you found was perhaps more involvement in what you call non-traditional political behavior, mm-hmm. but less sense of efficacy around traditional politics. What about that, and why might that be?
Yeah, so this is where the black politics part of it comes in. This book is about black attitudes, about a black art form, and I'm not really dealing with race or racism much in that book. What I find is that the kids that are most likely to express those attitudes are the kids that are most likely to be left out, not just by white politicians. They're also, I'd argue, are the ones that are most likely left out by black politicians. They're the ones most likely to be left out or discriminated in certain ways by black teachers, right? And I think that that causes them to feel less efficacious in that particular
space.
Well,
might the metaphor for that be the person we started our conversation with, former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, who famously pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice, was forced to resign as mayor in 2008 after a very sordid scandal involving his former chief of staff. Is that part of it? Is that kind of the right metaphor here, which is that this is, in a way, they're reflecting the failure of black leadership, particularly in major urban areas where the rise of black leadership was greeted with so much hope?
Yeah, so it's a few factors. So they're seeing black elected officials perform in certain ways, and then they're also seeing their interaction with politics on the ground is almost all negative. So it's not just that they're seeing political officials who end up doing things wrong and then that makes them feel less efficacious, is that there are no institutions that they're naturally involved in that indicate at all that they're worth listening to politically, that they're worth working with politically, that they're worth being treated as citizens.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with scholar and author Lester Spence. He's assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. You hear him frequently on Fridays in our barbershop roundtable. We're talking about his new book, Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip Hop and Black Politics. So what are we left with, Professor Spence? You know, really taken as a whole, your book is actually very sad. Or am I misreading it?
No, you're not. I mean, the subtitle or the title, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, right? So hip-hop is the most powerful musical art form that's been created in the last quarter of the 20th century, and it's culturally revolutionary in a number of different ways. But it just hasn't made it's not a political revolutionary force. And there are a number of things that constrain the ability of rap to perform that function in the United States.
Well, maybe you're asking too much of a musical or cultural form. I mean, nobody would say that, you know, the spirituals or the folk music of the civil rights movement transformed the country. It may have been the soundtrack of the movement, but I don't think anybody would say it was the songs that changed the country, right? Are you attributing too much to hip-hop?
Well, it's not me in this case, right? So I wrote this book as a way to understand and test a number of empirical claims that other people made about the music, right? Other people argued that it was this really revolutionary force. I didn't make those claims. I tested them.
Can I just ask this, Professor Spence, if you don't mind, is that your politics are, I don't think you're making any secret of this, very mm-hmm. left of center.
Mm-hmm.
So does hip-hop have anything to say, or is there a conservative strain of hip-hop?
I actually think that hip-hop is nationalist. And given that it's black nationalist in this specific time, I think hip-hop actually does tend to be conservative.
Hip-hop, and when you say conservative, what do you mean by that?
I mean it tends to be pro-business. It tends to be neoliberal. It tends to frown upon certain aspects of the welfare state. I analyzed over 500 lyrics from 1989 to 2004, and they go in on welfare recipients hard. They might as well be Newt Gingrich and blackface in some cases.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that because people associate hip hop with being very left, but you're saying it isn't.
No, it's pro-black, and we make this casualist link between being pro-black and being on the left.
Being on the left as it's defined
yeah.
more broadly, but you're saying
yeah.
it's just not true.
No, it's just not true. It's just not true. I mean, so take something like the Million Man March, 1995, where Minister Farrakhan calls a million black men to come to the seat of government and says, we don't want nothing. Now, people go to lobby to D.C. every day for millions and billions of dollars. But in that moment, Minister Farrakhan brings us all, because I was there too. He says, no, we're not coming for a handout for the government. We want to do for self. That is a message that's both black nationalist but extremely conservative. It's that type of combination that I see in hip-hop.
You know, finally, before we let you go, in other countries, like, for example, Wyclef Jean made an attempt to run for the president of Haiti. He did not succeed. He didn't even make it on the ballot. But another music star, Sweet Mickey Martelly, did prevail and is now the president of Haiti. In Senegal, Youssou N'Dour, tremendously influential Senegalese artist, is now running for the presidency of Senegal. Do you envision a time, I'm asking you to predict, and I know that's unfair, but do you envision a scenario in which people connected to hip-hop in the United States might rise to a level of political influence?
Well, people are already doing that, right? So you've got a guy like Rhyme Fest in Chicago who ran, and he actually didn't win, but he's not going anywhere. And I can easily see him and other people like him running for and attaining political office. And I think that as we get older, we have to remember the hip-hop generation, we still treat the hip-hop generation as if they're children, when in reality, the hip-hop generation, of which I'm a member, we're now middle age. So we're going to see naturally a number of people from within the field, within the industry, run for and win political office. I think the question for me, though, is what will be the political content of their efforts, right? So I can easily imagine somebody running for office under a hip-hop platform and connecting that platform to anti-tax policies. I can easily see them running and attaching hip-hop to the type of problematic security initiatives that we're now seeing. So the question isn't whether they'll get political influence. The question for me is, and this is my activist side coming out, to what extent will those policies, will those political practices be transformative?
Professor Spence, since it is Martin Luther King Day, it's the day when we commemorate the contributions of Martin Luther King Jr. to the country, I did want to ask, and I've been asking our previous guests, what civil rights means today. I thought I would like to ask you that question.
What it means today is reaching back and kind of reclaiming the public, making people understand that government actually can and is supposed to work for the people. And it starts in black communities. Well, those are the communities I care most about. And then taking those movements and building them outward. So actually today, I'm going to be working with the folks at Occupy Baltimore to occupy a site where they're talking about building a jail for youth who are charged as adults. And, you know, later on in the week, I'm going to be working with the Baltimore Mixtape Project to help further connect civil rights on the ground to hip-hop.
Lester Spence is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. He is also a regular contributor to our Friday Barbershop Roundtable. His new book is called Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. And he joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day, Lester Spence.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
And finally, just a few words from me on this special day. As you can tell, if you managed to hear any or all of today's program, then you know that the central question we've been grappling with is, what exactly does Dr. King's life and message mean to us now, some 43 years after his death, and so many years after the largely successful conclusion of the specific campaigns that defined his adult life? We're asking this question because you can see how the observance of this day could easily become one of those things you learn to do dutifully, but secretly dread, like a visit to your not very fun grandma, where you're forced to do without your video games while enduring cups of watery hot chocolate and interrogations about your posture. That's not what we want. What we're hoping for is a fresh take, an opportunity every year to pause and think about and do just what it is we need to do so that, to quote one of Dr. King's favorite scriptures, justice will roll down like the waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Can I just tell you, it seems to me that the real question is, what do we keep and what do we leave behind? What do we take with us into the future? Dr. King's deep empathy, moral reasoning, and personal courage? What do we leave behind? The pain, the struggle, the hurt? Years ago, when I was a correspondent at Nightline, I had the privilege of meeting two senior divas, one white, one black, who were almost exactly the same age and had both witnessed the same lynching, a real one, not someone's cheap metaphor, when they were both young girls.
I don't know what image people have of these things to the degree that they think about them at all, but it was not some quick surgical strike. It was a long, drawn-out, horrific affair that involved torturing, then hanging, then burning the victim, and dragging his lifeless body to the black side of town, where it would stay to serve as a warning to everyone who lived there. What I remember most about that trip, predictably, was the stuff that never made it into the piece. The white woman we interviewed presented that classic image of Southern female gentility. She served me and my camera crew tea and gave us a recitation of the facts as she remembered them. She didn't want to criticize anybody, but she made it clear that she knew then and later that whatever story she had been told about that terrible incident was not true, and that knowledge of untruth seemed to hover over her life. She'd learned very early the power of the big lie. And then we met the other senior diva, the black lady, and she was as sweet as she could be, too, or so it seemed until we began to roll tape. And she told us about the everyday hell that was her life. She remembered having to carry her father's dinner to him as he worked in the fields every day. And she told us of the ugly things the white men and boys would say to her as she walked, and how some would even grope her young body just because they could. And this is the part I'll never forget. At one point, she leaned to the side to look past me, to look at our white sound engineer directly in the face as she said, "Sir, I don't mean any harm, but this is how I learned to hate white people." My sound engineer told me later that it was one of the worst days of his life. What do we keep and what do we leave behind? Far be it for me to tell anybody who suffered trauma when and how they should get over it, but we can ask ourselves, like that black lady had, to try. And we can ask ourselves, like that white lady had, what deeper truths are there that perhaps we do not see? If nothing else, we might use this day not to ask what Martin Luther King would do if he were here, but what should we do? Like the treasures in Grandma's chest, some things don't fit or make sense, but some things should and will and must endure. And that is the burden and the gift that Martin Luther King gives us today. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.